Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The American push into space in the 1950s and 60s was a huge effort. Its public face was almost always white astronauts and white guys with white shirts and ties at mission control. But behind the scenes, a group of black women were calculating trajectories that put those astronauts into space. Their story is now getting a big telling. This hour on Point, the women of color in the engine of the space race. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you know this story? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the SpaceX rocket explosion last week and its fallout for missions ahead. But first, back to the space race itself. Just to put it in our minds and ears, here's a clip from a video of John Glenn preparing for the launch of the 1962 Mercury Atlas.
Colonel John H. Glenn, Jr. squeezes into his spacesuit. His smiling face belies the 10 postponements of his flight that have kept him grounded. This morning, the weather over Cape Canaveral and in the pickup areas is better, and there's an air of optimism as the colonel walks to the gantry elevator. Carrying his now familiar portable air conditioner, Glenn prepares to go to the 11th deck as clocks point to 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
John Glenn and the astronauts' faces from that era we know. The men, white men overwhelmingly, in mission control that we saw on television back in those days and on film clips that have survived very handsomely in YouTube times and in the movies, we know. But there's another story here. Joining me now from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Margot Lee Shetterly, author of the new book Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Margot Lee Shetterly, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Who were these women?
Well, these women, for me, I grew up in Hampton, Virginia. They were neighbors, they were friends, they were women at church. They were people who worked with my dad, who is a now retired NASA research scientist. But they also happened to be very good mathematicians. Most of them studied math in college, and they worked at the NASA Langley Research Center, which was originally called the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory. Over time, they made significant contributions to the study of aeronautics and later to the space race, as you just mentioned.
This happened, though, in a time when we still had Jim Crow laws very much in effect in this country and went on through the time of all the civil rights struggle. How did these women come into the realm of NASA and this aeronautics research in the first place, Margot?
It's very interesting, actually. During World War II, and World War II was a time that really changed so many things in our society for women of all colors, for African Americans, a civil rights leader named A. Philip Randolph pressured the then President Roosevelt to open the then segregated federal government to African Americans, essentially assuring African Americans of getting a seat at the table for these excellent war jobs, defense industry jobs. About 18 months after the executive order opening the federal government, applications filed by these women for civil service jobs started making it onto the desk of the Human Resources Department at the Langley Laboratory in Hampton, Virginia. During that time, with World War II in its full peak and a huge demand for safer airplanes, faster airplanes that were being flown overseas in Japan and in Europe, women were coming in and doing the hard legwork, the sort of, they were aeronautical ground troops, you might say. The calculations that today are done by electronic computers, they were doing in order to power the research behind those airplanes. These black women were brought in to do the same work that the white women were doing, only they were put into a segregated office, and they were known as the West Area Computers.
It's so interesting to think back to the language of that time. You use it throughout the book. But at this time, World War II, when people said computers, they did not mean machines. They meant people who did computation.
Exactly. I think it's important to know that for most of history, a computer was simply a person who computed. Like a trucker or a carpenter, a computer was someone who computed. And for much of the late 19th century and the 20th century, that person was a woman. A computer wasn't a piece of electronic hardware. A computer was someone who wore a skirt and did math all day long.
Why women in these very important calculating roles?
Well, Tom, in those days, computing was seen as something more of akin to a clerical job. The women who came in starting in 1935, that's when Langley established the first computing pool, they were something between pure clerical work and professional. So the men who were hired to do engineering and sometimes even mathematical work were considered professionals. There were women who came in as secretaries and clerks, and they were clerical workers. But these women came in as sub-professionals. They were paid less. They were very good at their jobs. It was a win for these organizations because the women were able to take away what was a very repetitive and could be a very tedious kind of work and make the computing and the analysis and research necessary for this development of aeronautics much more efficient, the same way that our jobs are made much more efficient by electronic computers.
Your book starts in 1943 in the midst of World War II. It ends with the moon landing. It may have been seen as clerical work, but what they were calculating over time became central, as you described for us, to the space race, the American missions into space. There were dozens or scores of these women, black women who were doing this. You profile four, among them Katherine Johnson, who listeners may have seen last year. President Obama presented her with the Presidential Medal of Freedom for her work with NASA. Here's the president.
Katherine calculated the flight path for America's first mission in space, the path that put Neil Armstrong on the moon. She was even asked to double-check the computer's math on John Glenn's orbit around the Earth.
She stood there in her 90s and accepted that highest of awards. Describe for us, if you would, Margot, how these calculations became central to the space missions that we know so well from the late 50s and onward.
Well, the thing that we have to remember is that even though we consider computers, electronic computers, to be extremely reliable today, back in the 50s and early 60s, when they were really just becoming, you know, a central part of the space program and of business computing of, you know, our lives back then, they weren't as reliable. People weren't as familiar with them. And there was concern about their accuracy and their reliability. Female computers, on the other hand, the women who did this this very necessary work, you could look them in the eye. They had a reputation for accuracy. You could reason with them. These women were the top of their class. They were extremely talented, and they got the numbers right. So at that moment, when John Glenn was preparing for his orbital flight and the first American orbital flight, and NASA was building a worldwide tracking network, an orbital or a computing and telecommunications network that would be able to track his capsule as it circled the globe. This required, you know, as you might imagine, a much higher degree of computing power, more than could have been actually done by the women who had been doing the work to that point. But as one of the sort of checks before, you know, and there were many people working on this. There were obviously many checklists and many things for them to check before this mission was something that could actually take off. But among them was Mrs. Johnson was asked to compare the numbers that she got, and she wrote a report in 1959, essentially describing the math, doing the equations for what it would take to send this capsule around the Earth. She was asked in the countdown in the weeks before John Glenn's flight to compare her output, what she got calculating the numbers by hand, with what the computer's output, their automatic output. And that was, you know, a way to kind of calibrate and make sure that that this very highly talented human computer and this newfangled electronic computer were on the same page before this mission was ready to go.
And, of course, these trajectories for launch and for landing had everything to do with the success of the missions, the safety of those who were on them. John Glenn cared a lot about that. Here's a little tape of Katherine Johnson for the TV series Makers. She was talking about working with John Glenn to calculate those trajectories that determine timing for launch and descent.
At a given time, you tell him to descend with mathematical equations. And if he descends the way you tell him, he'll hit the water when you tell him. He had confidence in what we had computed for him, and he had to do it just as we said.
Margot Lee Shetterly, John Glenn wanted that human backup, so that double check, and he got it.
He did. You know, Mrs. Johnson just turned 98 years old last Friday.
Yeah.
She is still charismatic, interesting, charming. And, you know, we should all be lucky to have a mind as sharp as hers today, not just at age 98. And, you know, the thing that's pretty remarkable to me when you ask her, you know, how did you handle the pressure? You know, here she is sitting in a room going through a stack of data sheets by hand, you know, with a man's life on the line, and not just, you know, his life, but the entire world, you know, looking, and the United States very much interested in proving its pride. And she was up for the job. She did it, and she did it well.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this about the crew of black women mathematicians who helped put America in space when the country was still coming out of Jim Crow laws and segregation. My guest is Margot Lee Shetterly. She's written a new book. It's called Hidden Figures, The American Dream, and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. It'll be a motion picture, a major motion picture later this year. Here's a clip from the trailer for Hidden Figures. It's out at the end of the year, starring Taraji P. Henson, Octavia Spencer, Janelle Monáe, and Kevin Costner.
In 14 days, astronauts will be here for training. Everything we do is going to matter to their wives, to their children. I believe it's going to matter to the whole damn country.
My gals are ready. We can do the work.
That's John Glenn.
What do you ladies do for NASA?
Calculate launch and landing, sir.
Engineering.
And I'm proud as the devil to be working with you.
How could you possibly be ogling these white men?
It's equal rights. I have the right to see fine in every color.
There's no protocol for women attending.
There's no protocol for a man circling the earth either, sir.
No protocols here. You can join us this hour. What do you hear in this story of black women's talents being tapped in the race to the moon? Have you thought of NASA, of science, as a frontier for civil rights? Is it nice to think of women in the space program not just being astronaut wives, women calculating when and how to put those rockets into space, and women in science? What do you hear in this story? In August, actress Taraji P. Henson talked with the Associated Press about discovering the story behind Hidden Figures, the story of the women like Katherine Johnson, who she'll play in the movie out nationwide at the end of the year.
Who knew that women had anything to do with men getting to the moon? Who knew? You see all the footage, all the documentaries, and you just see a room full of smoking men. So then I find out about these women, and I redo my research, and I'm like, okay, where's the woman? I know I'm going to see her, because now I know they exist. That bothered me. And I made it my mission to do this film.
Margot Lee Shetterly is with us. We'll talk in a moment with the deputy administrator of NASA about this history. Margot Lee Shetterly, you look at these at four of these women, Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, Mary Jackson, Christine Darden. What did they make of showing up and being in segregated quarters at the Langley Research Center that you know so well?
Well, they at the time that they came to the Langley Research Center, segregation, Jim Crow segregation in Virginia and throughout the South was an unfortunate fact of life for them and other African Americans. So, you know, they went to segregated schools. They got on the train and went to a segregated car. There were restaurants they couldn't go to. So there was no surprise that in this workplace, they also found a segregated cafeteria, segregated bathrooms, a segregated workroom. At the same time, obviously, like the rest of the African-American community, they did what they could to expand their experience and expand their dignity to break down those rules and laws of segregation. And so I think very frequently we focus on the big moments of the civil rights movement, on, you know, this sort of slavery, civil rights, Obama narrative. And all too often we leave out the everyday actions of women like these who have a huge impact over time on equality and on justice and on potential for generations who come behind them. That's what those women did.
May 1961, astronaut Alan Shepard became the first American man in space with the help of mathematicians like Katherine Johnson, one of the four profiled, and many more than that, who were black women and mathematicians put to work here. She calculated the trajectory of his flight. Here's the sound of the Mercury Freedom 7 liftoff, his liftoff.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Liftoff. All right, liftoff, and the clock is started.
And, of course, it went all the way to the story of American astronauts going to the moon. Here's an interview with the TV series makers, and the same Katherine Johnson said she was proudest of the work she did on the Apollo mission.
I felt most proud of the success of the Apollo mission. They were going to the moon. I computed the path that would get you there. You determined where you were on Earth when you started out, and where the moon would be at a given time. We told them how fast they would be going, and the moon would be there by the time you got there.
I computed the path, she says, and she's not talking about punching it into a computer. She did it herself. John in Yellow Springs, Ohio. John, you're on with Margo Lee Shetterly. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to put in there that, you know, these people those days, they worked with slide rulers. They didn't have computers. They were the computers. You know, and I think they calculated even those lunar orbits or insertion of lunar orbits using slide rulers. I might be wrong on that, but, you know, which is a skill we don't teach kids anymore to use slide rulers, as far as I know. But, you know, that's pretty darn amazing, I think.
It is pretty amazing. Just a slide rule, and they did it. Margo, thank you, John, for your call. Margo, tell us more about the calculations they did, what exactly they were working on, and how complex these were.
Yeah, I can tell you that I actually spent a lot of time looking for slide rules on eBay and buying them and trying to learn how to use them. And it's not easy. So, yeah,
They used to be in everybody's behind the pocket protector if you were a geek or a mathematician back in those days. And sure, computers sort of made them obsolete.
Exactly. But the work that they did varied from simple arithmetic calculations to trigonometry, analytic geometry, calculus, differential equations. In the early days, a lot of what the women did was to calculate the pressure distribution over the wing of an airplane with the idea that they could basically make a wing move more efficiently through the air. And then with the advent of the space program, the work that Katherine Johnson was doing was really calculating first the sort of parabolic trajectory of Alan Shepard's flight, which basically went up into the air and then came back down, and then calculating the full elliptical flight of John Glenn's orbit. So, you know, for me, as a non-scientist, a lot of what I spent time doing was going through the NASA technical report server and actually pulling out some of the original work, such as Katherine Johnson's 1959 report that did this math. And, you know, certainly not understanding it in a way that she does, but, you know, just getting a real sense for how difficult this was, how challenging this was, and how important it was that the numbers be absolutely correct.
Katherine Johnson's been described as a math savant. She graduated summa cum laude from what's now West Virginia State University. I mean, how did these young women even get the word that this was open to them? Were they recruited? Were they, I mean, this was brand new that the federal government would bring African Americans into roles like this at the beginning.
In the beginning, it was difficult to get the word around. But, Tom, one of the most important tools for recruiting, particularly the black women, were black newspapers. During World War II, black newspapers published articles. They campaigned tirelessly to tell African Americans that, you know, this executive order that A. Philip Randolph worked so hard to put into effect is opening these jobs for us. You know, go down to the civil service office, make sure that you apply for these jobs. Here are training programs. So the very first group of women in May of 1943 who actually took their jobs at what was called the West Computing Office had gone through a war training program in Hampton, Virginia, at a school that's now called Hampton University, then Hampton Institute. So black newspapers and historically black colleges were hugely influential in helping these women find out about their jobs.
And in they came, and these were good jobs for African Americans of that time, and not so long afterward for your father, who joined their ranks. Lisa, in Augusta, Georgia. Lisa, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Margot Lee Shetterly.
I wanted to ask Margot if, when she heard the story, if at first did she believe it, and if also if you did not believe it, at what point in your research did you come to believe it?
Well, I believed it because I knew it was true from the very beginning. I grew up in Hampton, Virginia. My dad worked at NASA. A lot of these women worked with him. I knew Katherine Johnson when I was a little girl. These were people who were part of the community. So
now Medal of Freedom recipient. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. And so as a result of growing up there, I saw black women who were mathematicians and engineers. I saw white women who were mathematicians and engineers, black men, white men. You know, I saw all of these people working at NASA. And so very fortunately for me, I really didn't have a sort of restrictive idea of who could be a scientist or mathematician or what they looked like. So, but it did take a real shift in perception for me, and I think a lot of us who grew up with these women, who knew these women, to fully appreciate the value of their work.
The significance of what they did. Kimmy in Bellbuckle, Tennessee. Kimmy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Sure. What strikes me about this is how potentially different our whole society would be if these kinds of stories weren't now major motion pictures, but had been incorporated into our history as just everyday history and part of the history books, part of our the story at the time, part of the representation in TV and movies, so that women and people from minority communities saw these as viable opportunities, but also people from the predominant white community just expected people from minority communities and women to be part of furthering our society. And the fact that we have such a, our history books limit the story, keeps us from seeing the full picture, yeah. And then it makes it a big news story.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and we know what those images looked like, both what we saw on television back then at Mission Control, what we saw in the astronaut lineups. Margot Lee Shetterly tells us a different story. I mean, as an African-American yourself, Margot, how do you feel about getting this out there? And Kimmy's point that if it had always been talked about, we might have a couple of generations now of young people who had flowed in this direction and seen themselves as capable and welcome.
I think it's a great point. You know, all too often we see these sort of different threads of history. We see African-Americans protagonists in a story like this, we say it's a black story. If there are female protagonists in a story, we say it's a female story only for women. Well, this is a story where the protagonists are black and they are female, and they are as American as it gets. You know, I think one of the really exciting things about this story is that this is capital H American history. You know, it's the space program, it's World War II, it's the Cold War. And it is a group of African-American women carrying the flag high, you know, with all of the challenges that come with that, with all of the difficult parts that come with that. This is a truly American capital H story, and I think that's a really exciting thing and very transformative.
Right through to the first moonshot itself. Here's the sound of Apollo 11 lifting off 1969. It made astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin the first humans on the moon.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
Tower cleared. Margot, please stand by there in Virginia. With us right now from Houston, Texas, is David Newman. She's Deputy Administrator of NASA. Apollo Program Professor of Aeronautics at MIT on leave there now to be at NASA. David Newman, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello. What a pleasure to be with you.
How do you see the significance of this story coming out in Margot's book, in the movie that will come later this year?
Oh, this is huge. This is the story and the history that needs to be written. Women at NASA have always been pioneers, and so to get this is such an excellent book. Thank you, Margot, and for telling our story and telling, you know, the women pioneers. There's so many of them, and the stories do need to be told, how instrumental and crucial they were. And our missions at NASA are really hard, and they demand excellence, and diversity is how we get excellence.
You went for a long time yourself with all of your education in this, with never having been taught by a female engineer. If we tell the story more fully, more deeply, if we get this kind of story out there, is that more likely to be the future, that you've got, you know, women on all sides of these equations?
I think so. We need young girls and boys alike to see themselves in these roles. If they dream of building and flying and sending humans to Mars, our current mission, then we really need to have those young folks. I call them the Mars generation. They're in high school and college today. They're the Mars generation because we'll get humans to Mars in the 2030s. But they do need to see themselves as scientists, engineers, and in the STEM fields really hold the excitement to serve society, really to change the world. I do also bring in the A for arts. That's the storytellers, the historians. This writing, the movie that's coming up, and D for design, the makers. There's a maker generation out there. They see themselves as designers. Our message is we're inclusive. We need everyone. We need all these great brains. So I think we need to change the conversation to be very inclusive. Not you have to be the best in calculus and physics and math. That's how I was taught as an aerospace engineer. Rather, we say those are tools. You need to be proficient, but we want everyone to really achieve these great goals.
David, do you know the history of this from the sort of inside NASA perspective? Do NASA people know that there was this stream of black women mathematicians who were doing a lot, you know, with slide rules and before computers, doing a lot of the calculation that put NASA into spaces? Has that been a well-known fact within NASA? Has that been appreciated?
Is definitely appreciated in our Langley Research Center, as was mentioned. That's where it all started. It's very inclusive in getting all the best mathematicians. But we need to spread the word more broadly at NASA and then definitely more broadly out to society. We're really incredibly proud of these pioneers, these pioneering women and men that did get us to the moon. That's probably why I'm in my job today. That was my dream. Mm-hmm. You know, all dreams seem possible when we sent humans to the moon, and now we're onward to sending humans to Mars.
Margot, how do you think NASA is doing these days when it comes to bringing in women and women of color, people of color, to their ranks?
I think, you know, that stories like these really shine a light on the people who are there in NASA. I think there are quite a few. In fact, I know, you know, for being from a NASA community, many of these women. And since I've started writing this book, I get emails all the time from black women, from women of all backgrounds, working as scientists and engineers at NASA. And so I think bringing them out of the shadows really will help a lot for the recruitment and for the perception and for, you know, all of us understanding what a scientist looks like, that they probably exist in greater numbers than our public perception. And that even as we want to have a more inclusive and more diverse workforce, I think that a lot of times we don't even see the women and the women of color who are there. So hopefully this will help us to see them and not just look past them.
David, we just got you for 20 more seconds. What's your goal now in terms of diversity within those ranks?
Our goal is to be excellent, and we need to really normalize the numbers so that we really represent the diverse talent pool that we have right in America right now. So our numbers aren't what we want them to be at NASA or in academia, but we're on it, and we want to work on it together. We really do need a step change and improvement to make sure that we have all the best and the brightest, and we open our doors, our minds, and our hearts, and we get everyone in.
Deva Newman is Deputy Administrator of NASA right now, joining us today from Houston, Texas. Thanks so much for being with us, Deva.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the crew of black women mathematicians who helped put America in space when the country was still coming out of Jim Crow laws and segregation. Margot Lee Shetterly writes about it in her new book, Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. It will be a big motion picture at the end of this year with Taraji P. Henson, Kevin Costner, and more in that. You can join us this hour. Women in Science, what do you hear in this story? Will you take your daughter to see Taraji P. Henson and co. reenact, dramatize this history? And how do we even now tap the talents of all our citizens? We'll talk about SpaceX and what's going on that privatized space exploration front before this hour's over. Margot Lee Shetterly's in Charlottesville, Virginia, and lots of calls for you. T in Malden, Massachusetts. You're on with Margot.
Hi, Tom. Just a comment, and I wanted to thank you for helping to publicize the story of these remarkable women. I believe they shatter every stereotype that exists about women and specifically about black women. And I just wanted to thank you for bringing this to light. I've never heard about them.
Very, very happy to do it. I hadn't either, T, and we're glad to do it. Margot, stand by one more. Irene in Bedford, Massachusetts. Irene, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I'm just calling on behalf of my aunt, whose name also was Irene. She was Irene Murphy, and she was the main administrative assistant to the director of NASA in Cambridge, all during from the late 60s to the early 80s, which was during the Apollo work.
Push. Yeah.
And toward the end of her career, she had a staff of 18 secretaries working under her in the director's office, and they played, you know, a very important role. And even though she wasn't black, she was Irish, which was also not an especially favored ethnic group in Boston,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the early 1900s when she was growing up. So
was NASA a good place for your aunt, Irene? Was it a good place for her?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was great. She just had to retire because she had to take care of my grandmother. But, you know, she didn't have the opportunity for an education. My mother actually became a scientist. She was lucky to get an education. But, you know, my aunt still, we used to make a joke about how she used to run NASA because the doctor was always busy doing other things, you know. So she was basically, you know, executing his orders or whatever.
That's pretty great. As an Irish immigrant, so you've got a special sympathy for this conversation, and I appreciate your call, Irene. Margo?
Tom, I wanted to just say thanks, Irene, for telling that story. I mean, I found stories after stories of exactly that, of Irish women, of Jewish women who were, you know, in very similar situations to these African American women. And, you know, the cohort of total women, black women, white women. There were stories of Native American women, you know, that I found, Latina women on the West Coast. You know, this story is takes place on the East Coast in Virginia. So the women are predominantly black and white. But there were hundreds of women, perhaps more than 1,000, who came through the Langley Research Center, thousands who worked at the different NASA centers. There were women who worked at the Army's Ballistic Research Laboratory in Philadelphia. There were women working at the Bureau of Standards. So, you know, the black women that I knew were perhaps more hidden than the other professionals there. But this really is a story of using them to shine a light on the work that all of the women did over the time that we're looking at.
Chris in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Chris, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to say that I think one of the issues here is that as a public, we may not have recognized these women, but the guys who were really at the tip of the spear, the Neil Armstrongs, the Michael Collins, they spoke frequently of the vast number of Americans who assisted. And I feel as though the public may not have appreciated, but the guys who were supported to get the mission done,
yeah,
they all saw it as being a group effort. Michael Collins, in particular, in his autobiography, puts a heavy emphasis on that. And like I said, it may not have been to the fore for us, but I think the guys who rode these machines really appreciated it and understood it.
If you were in it, you knew it. If your life was on the line, Margot, do you agree?
I do agree. You know, everyone talks about the team effort. You talk to the women about the very close relationships they had with the engineers that they worked with. And I think, you know, apparently the number is that 400,000 people were required to get Apollo 11 to the moon. You know, obviously one single person can't do it. And if you are that person riding out there, with two colleagues in you know, basically a tuna fish can, you're going to understand better than anyone just how many people it takes to get you out there and get you back safely. So I do agree with that.
Milton in Nashville, Tennessee. Milton, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to say that my mom, is Yvonne Y. Clark, is one of those African-American engineers who worked on the Apollo missions. As a mechanical engineer, she worked on the Saturn V rocket and the moon box to bring the moon samples back in.
Wow, that's fantastic. And where did she do that? What physical location, Milton?
Well, what she taught at Tennessee State University here in Nashville, Tennessee, but during the summer, because that time TSU wasn't year-round, she would work for the government during the summer, and NASA is who she worked for. I would go with her, you know, on these trips to Houston, and it was amazing. It was an amazing experience,
Was she proud of the work that she did? She must have been very proud. We're talking about a moonshot here.
Well, the thing is that for her, it was a job. It was being a patriot. It was doing an American thing. It was kind of like that John F. Kennedy thing, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And that was the spirit in which she worked.
Well, it's just fantastic. Milton, I appreciate your call from Nashville. One more while we have time from Virginia Beach. Virginia, Donald, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me. I would just like to say that I'm proud to hear this. I just happened by chance to listen to this on the radio. As a father of two young black ladies, one in education, other in family services, I'm proud to know that these black women have laid the foundation for our future generation. I hope they take a hold of it. And it's a shame that I had to get in my late 50s to find out about these ladies. And it's a shame for America to hold this behind and not promote this as they do other ladies in their careers. And just proud, happy black man in this country, believe it or not.
Yes,
my
sir.
Two daughters graduated from a good institution, and I just wish I'd have known this earlier and maybe pursued them to go to a career like what the young lady has promoted. And just proud to have known this and growing up in the state of Mississippi, this is great.
Donald, we've got it, and I'm very grateful for your call as well. Thank you so much for that. Margo, I guess that is no small part of what you're hoping for right there, that this is known and shared with young people coming up, perhaps in the sciences.
Yeah, absolutely. With young people, with old people, with black people, everyone. I think this is, again, this is a great American story and inspiring to all of us.
The movie comes out later this year. Have you seen early drafts of it? Do they capture it?
I've seen some clips, and I think everybody working on the movie is really hoping to transmit the power and the inspirational nature of these women and their work.
Taraji P. Henson, Octavia Spencer, Janelle Monáe, they'll all be in it. Kevin Costner as well. Margot Lee Shetterly tells the story behind the film coming out later this year in her new book, Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. Margot, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. It was my pleasure.
In a moment, we'll look at the aftermath of the big SpaceX rocket explosion at Cape Canaveral last week. This is On Point. The The image of the fireball last week in Cape Canaveral as a massive explosion took down a SpaceX rocket is hard to forget. We wanted to know the implications of that blow-up. With us to look at that right now from Cape Canaveral, Florida, is Mike Wall, senior writer for Space.com. Mike, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. What happened? What went wrong last week, Mike?
Well, they're still looking into that. They're still not entirely sure, or if they know, they still haven't told us yet. The latest SpaceX updates are basically that they've pinned down where it started is in the upper stage oxygen tank, and kind of when they were loading fuel. This was during a pre-launch test. It was about 2 days ahead of when they wanted to launch, and they were just testing out the engines, standard procedure to make sure everything was going well, and it was not going well, and the thing blew up. It could take some time before they figure out exactly what went wrong, and we'll just have to wait and see.
This was the sound on Thursday during a test launch, SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket exploding at liftoff. Mike, what are the implications of this? We've privatized a fair portion of what goes into space now. SpaceX is right at the heart of that privatization effort. What about, are they going to recreate everything that got destroyed there in that, $250 million capsule on top? Are they going to do that all over again? And what about other missions that may now be waiting for their turn into space?
Yeah, well, that's what a lot of people are kind of waiting to see, what the fallout of this is going to be. SpaceX is, they're at the heart of this kind of private space flight kind of revolution that we're seeing right now. They've got 70 missions already lined up, commercial and also government providers. They've got about $10 billion in launch contracts lined up. And it'll be interesting to see if they're able to kind of keep that schedule ticking over, if they're going to be able to stay on time or kind of reasonably on time, because there are going to be delays. It's just a question of how long those delays are going to be. And that's something that we really can't predict. We have to figure out first what happened, and if it's going to require a big redesign of the Falcon 9, or if it was just a glitch that just kind of a one-off anomaly that is not going to happen again, or they're confident it won't happen again. There are all sorts of knock-on effects to this that we won't really know about until they figure out what went wrong and how long it'll take to fix it, and if there will be confidence kind of drops across the industry in SpaceX. I'm not saying that there will be, but this is the second accident for them in the last 14 months. People might remember in June of 2015 they were launching a Dragon space mission. It's just like a cargo ship to the International Space Station for NASA, and it exploded about 3 minutes after takeoff from Cape Canaveral. And they trace that back to one faulty strut in the Falcon 9 out of hundreds of struts that go into building these rockets. But they were grounded for about 6 months after that, 5.5, 6 months. And so that was a big deal for them and for the industry, and we'll just have to see what happens in the aftermath of this explosion.
You point out that SpaceX has something like a 93-95% success rate, no more accidents than other space companies or organizations. What about compared to NASA? How are they doing by comparison to NASA's success rate in, mounting successful launches?
Well, if you look at NASA, probably what most people think about NASA is the space shuttle, right? And there were a few tragic accidents with the space shuttle, obviously. They lost Challenger in 1986, and then they lost Columbia in 2003. And so that's two failures out of 135 manned missions. That's manned missions, and those are, you expect a little bit more stringency there. You have less margin for error, and it's not as acceptable to kind of have to have a launch failure when there are astronauts on board. But that just goes to show, even when the stakes are so high and there are lives that could be lost, there are still accidents, And it's not because people have necessarily failed to do due diligence. It's partly because this is a very risky industry, and there are going to be accidents just because when you launch a rocket, it's a controlled explosion basically, and there's so much energy involved that things can and do go wrong. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to actually do 100% right over and over again. There are going to be accidents in this business, and people know that, but it's always jarring to actually see it, partly because it's so dramatic and because
it sure is
so high.
Sure. Mike, where are we in the evolution to commercial supply of everything going on up in space now? I mean, there was the shuttle. We got rid of that. We relied on the Russians for a while. Do we still? And if SpaceX is in a hiatus here of some kind, what missions may be held up?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. We're in a transition period right now. It's been 5 years since the last space shuttle mission, and like in that time, we've been totally reliant on Russia to actually launch our astronauts and to bring them back down. But we're coming up on the end of that like total dependency, because there are two American firms, actually SpaceX, one of them, Boeing, is the other, have been contracted to design spaceships to carry NASA astronauts to and from the space station. And they were supposed to be, both of them, I mean, NASA had hoped that they would be on schedule to start launching astronauts by sort of late 2017, early 2018. So that's pretty much just around the corner at this point. And so we're in this transition period between NASA kind of handing off that sort of low Earth orbit International Space Station taxi service to private industry, you know, SpaceX and Boeing, and there are a few other players in that field, while they kind of devote all their resources in manned spaceflight to like getting astronauts to Mars and all these other kind of far off distant destinations.
After we saw what happened last week, are they, you know, with that explosion, are they still on track to start taking humans, Americans, into space next year?
Yeah, it's a good question. We're gonna have to wait and see. I mean, because the like Falcon 9 is that's the type of rocket that just had the accident last week. It's a version of the Falcon 9 that's going to be launching astronauts to the space station. So, we'll have to see what the problem was with the explosion, what caused it, and until we actually know what the problem was, we won't know how long it's going to take them to fix it. We'll just have to wait and see. It's only been like a few days since the accident, and I mean, we probably won't know what the effects are for, I don't know, weeks or months to come.
A 15-story rocket up in flames last week at Cape Canaveral in Florida. SpaceX, of course, the author of that, and a lot of the future of the American space program dependent in the planning, anyway, on these commercial providers. We'll continue to watch what we learn about that accident and what's coming as they step deeper into space. Mike Wall is senior writer for Space.com, joined us from Cape Canaveral. Mike, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. ¶¶